You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the Essentials of Noetic Sciences series. I'm Lindsay King, and tonight our host is IONS Senior Scientist Dean Radin, and he will introduce his guest, Bruce Grayson. Welcome, Dean.
Thank you, Lindsay, and welcome, Bruce. My guest today is Bruce Grayson. Bruce is the Chester Carlson Professor of Psychiatry and a Division Director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. This is, I think, the only academic center in the world that is devoted to issues having to do with survival of bodily death, or the research in that topic. Bruce Grayson was for many years the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Near-Death Studies, from 1982 to 2007, and he wrote the overview of near-death experiences for the Encyclopedia Britannica. His research has been cited many times because of scales that he has developed for reviewing measures of near-death experience and measures of experiences like Kundalini. So welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for inviting me.
So since we're talking about near-death experience, I guess I'll start with an article that I noticed recently on near-death experience, which attempted to explain the typical characteristics of a near-death experience through things like lack of oxygen in the brain and the way that the eye behaves when oxygen is disappearing and so on.
Right.
I know you have many excellent ways of responding to those kinds of assumptions, which I know is held by many in the academic mainstream. But maybe before we get to that, you can give an overview of what a typical near-death experience is like, and then we can address some of the usual explanations that are proposed to explain such things.
Okay, well, a typical near-death experience occurs when someone is on the threshold of death. Sometimes they actually have been pronounced dead. And in this setting of usually fear and pain and trauma, they are suddenly overwhelmed by tremendous sense of peace and well-being. They may have a complete absence of any pain. They have a sense of leaving the physical body. Often they can look back and see the physical body from another visual perspective. They may then go through a tunnel, a dark enclosed space, to a brilliant light that is seen as being, experienced as being a living being, not just a light, but a living being of light. They may encounter other beings there, sometimes deceased loved ones or spiritual beings, a deity sometimes, that may guide them through a review of their lives. And they sometimes go on to enter some other unearthly realm before finally coming to a point of no return, at which point they either come back voluntarily or sometimes are sent back against their will. That's essentially the things that you see in near-death experiences. Of course, not everybody has all of those features.
Right.
Okay. As for the explanations, if you want to jump into that.
Sure.
The one you mentioned about anoxia causing parts of the brain to shut down and peripheral vision being lost, that's actually one of the sillier explanations that I've heard. Because what that basically says is that, as your brain does lose oxygen, you lose peripheral vision so that your vision narrows, and that can look like going into a tunnel in the sense of your visual field getting smaller and smaller. But that is not, in fact, what people report as a tunnel in a near-death experience. They don't report losing peripheral vision and the visual field getting smaller and smaller. In fact, they retain vision of the whole visual field, and they actually see a structured tunnel, not just blackness, but they describe the walls of the tunnel, sometimes in very vivid details, not at all like tunnel vision. But, you know, there have been many physiological explanations, drugs given to people, lack of oxygen to the brain, temporal lobe misfirings, various drugs being produced by the brain under stress. The problem with all of these physiological explanations is that they're all based on the brain not functioning or not functioning properly, a malfunction of the brain causing this hallucination. And what that doesn't allow for is the incredibly enhanced mental functioning that you see typically in near-death experiences. Most near-death experiences have incredibly clear thinking. People report their thought processes are clearer and faster and more logical than they are normally. They have vivid perceptions. Colors, sounds are more vivid than ever. And they have afterward a very clear memory for the whole experience. And the problem with the physiological explanations is that everything we know about malfunctions of the brain produce confused thinking, not clear thinking, clouded perceptions, not clear perceptions, and no memory or very poor memory, not clear memory. So none of the physiological explanations really even address the main features of near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm. Given that the near-death experiences don't occur to everyone who is near death, what explanation is there for why these occur to 20 to 30% of the people rather than everyone?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know that I have the answer for that. There have been several studies now done of a whole group of patients who came equally close to death. Usually this is done with people who have cardiac arrests. They've been done in the U.S., in the U.K., in the Netherlands, and they all come up with basically the same figures, between 10 and 20% of people who have a documented cardiac arrest will report a near-death experience. Now, one of the problems we're dealing with here is that what that means is that 10 to 20% will remember and report the experience to the investigator. That's not the same thing as saying that 10 to 20% actually have the experience. Mm. Some people may, in fact, have it and not remember it. Some people may remember it and choose not to share it with the investigator. So we don't really know how many people actually have a near-death experience. Given that, I think it's fair to say that not everybody has them. And I don't think we know why that is. It may be that some people don't come close enough to death to have one. It may be that only certain personality types will have a near-death experience. For example, people who are extremely rigid and unable to let go may not allow themselves, in a sense, to experience a near-death experience, just as they don't remember their dreams and don't allow themselves to have other emotional experiences. Mm-hmm. But we don't really know the answer to this question yet of why some people have a near-death experience and some people don't. I often ask near-death experiencers why that is, and the answer they usually give me is something like, you get what you need in the experience. And if you need a certain type of experience, that is what you will get.
Mm-hmm. Have there been cases of people who had multiple near-death experiences, but in some cases they reported something, in other cases they experienced nothing?
Yes, that has happened. We have had several people who reported several near-death experiences, two, three, four experiences. And I've also talked to people who had a very beautiful near-death experience, and then some years later had another close brush with death and had nothing, and were often very disappointed in that.
Mm-hmm. So among other reasons, if someone was enthralled by the concept of a near-death experience, then trying to create one may not be such a great idea because they, statistically speaking at least, are likely to be disappointed by not having anything.
Yeah, well, in fact, if you try to bring about a near-death experience, it's not likely that you will actually have one. If you look at the content and the process of a near-death experience, one of the critical factors often seems to be letting go, giving up control, or having control wrested from you. Sometimes people will report approaching death and trying very hard to stay alive, trying very hard to stay in control, and fighting very hard against losing control. And at some point, they get exhausted and give in and just let go. And when they let go, they're able to have this experience.
Mm-hmm.
We find that those people who are able to let go are the ones who have the more elaborate experiences and have the more profound after effects. So if you are trying to bring about a near-death experience, and people have tried this with drugs, with various other means, you are not actually letting go. You're not giving up control. You're trying to maintain control. And I think that works against actually having the experience.
So that raises the question of whether the AWARE project, the AWARE standing for Awareness During Resuscitation, that's headed by Dr. Sam Parnia, whether that you think might work or not work, given that the notion of giving up is not there on the part of the experimenters, but it still may be there on the part of the people who are undergoing the surgery.
Right. For those listeners who may not be familiar with the AWARE study, which was, as you said, started by Sam Parnia, is a multinational study of people who have cardiac arrests, looking at the characteristics and incidence of near-death experiences in these folks. And there are, I believe, now some 20 hospitals in the UK that have entered this study. We have just started at the University of Virginia, and there are a couple of other places in the U.S. that are about to start. And I believe there is one in Switzerland and one that's being planned in Canada and one in Japan. So we will hopefully get some cross-coastal data as well in this. And one factor on this is just looking at the frequency of near-death experiences in people who have cardiac arrest. Now, these are all done in hospitals. So looking at people who have their cardiac arrest, their hearts stop, while they are in a hospital, so we know exactly when it is happening. And usually we have a lot of physiological monitoring going on with these folks. Another aspect of this study, though, is that there are hidden visual targets being placed in the hospital rooms up near the ceiling facing upwards, so you can only see the targets if you're up near the ceiling looking down. And these are being placed in almost all the rooms of the hospital so that when a patient has a cardiac arrest in the hospital and reports leaving their body, they may see this target. Now, that's the goal of the study. When I mention this study to near-death experiences, they are often incredulous that we are planning this because their impression is, why would somebody who was just out of their body for the first time going into this incredible experience think to look at some target you've placed somewhere in the corner of the room that's totally irrelevant to them? Why would they look at it? Why would they remember it? There's no motivation there to do so. It's not relevant to them. So I'm not sure whether it really will be a successful study or not in that regard. Certainly, if we have people who are accurately report these hidden targets, that will be impressive. If we fail to have people report those targets, I'm not sure what we can say about that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if people describe accurately other things going on in resuscitation attempts but fail to report the designated target, does that count against them?
Right. And, of course, I think the idea of the hidden target was brought about because of people's reports in an operating room where they felt that they floated to the ceiling and they could look around.
That's right. That's right. And we have many of these anecdotes. In fact, Jan Holden at the University of North Texas actually looked at 100 different published reports of these out-of-body perceptions. And she found that about 86% of these had been corroborated by somebody else. In other words, a third person also said, yes, these perceptions were accurate. In 92% of these cases, they were entirely accurate. In only 1% were they inaccurate. So we have a lot of anecdotes to say that people really can see accurately from an out-of-body perspective. Now, of course, the skeptical perspective on this is that we don't know whether these were likely guesses. For example, if someone said, I was up near the ceiling and saw that the surgeon had a bald spot in the back of his head, well, that's a good guess. And a lot of people may say, you know, of course, that's a likely thing to guess. So the idea of putting these targets is they would be very unlikely targets, and they're targets that we would know the odds of guessing it correctly or not. So So it's a little more controlled than just whatever the person having the experience happens to notice and report.
Mm-hmm. Recently, Raymond Moody has been talking about cases of where more than one person might experience something like a near-death experience. One person may be near death and have the classic experience, but other people feel something unusual as well. Can you tell us anything about that line of research?
A little bit. This is an area where it's hard to do controlled research because it happens spontaneously. But there have been reports for many, many years about people who are at the bedside of someone who was going through a dying process. And at the point the person dies, the caretaker who was there with them experiences something. And sometimes they just see a mist or something rising from the person's body as they're dying. But sometimes the bystander actually accompanies the person through parts of the near-death experience. And they may, in fact, see the tunnel, see the light, encounter the same deceased entities that the near-death experiencer does. And in some cases, they even report seeing some of the life review of the person who was dying. Now, again, these are just anecdotes, and it's hard to corroborate any of this information, but they are very interesting reports.
Right, which suggests, among other things, that besides the shared nature, presumably the shared nature of what's going on, that you don't need to have such an extraordinary altered state in order to have some of these experiences.
I mean, that raises the question of how do we measure an altered state? A lot of people have near-death experiences when they are physiologically near-death, such as when their heart stops, but people also have them when they are simply afraid they're going to die. For example, people who fall from great heights or people who are in automobile accidents but aren't physiologically near death but fear they're going to die imminently often have the same types of near-death experiences. So you don't have to be physiologically impaired to have a near-death experience, which again speaks against some of the physiological explanations that have been put forward about lack of oxygen to the brain and so forth.
Right. Well, but people who think that they're about to die presumably are going through a huge adrenaline rush, among other things.
Right.
So they may not, in fact, be prepared to be dead, but this is quite different than if someone is accompanying a dying person. They may be emotional, but they won't necessarily have the same kind of a huge physiological rush that's associated with falling off a building, say. So that's what I meant by you don't need
right.
extremes of push. You don't need to push the person physically very far. That may be just the right context.
That's true.
The other thing that I hear again and again is that people who have a near-death experience come back, and not only is their personality transformed, usually towards a positive direction, but also they report that they're much more psychic.
That's often been reported. The problem is that no one has ever tried to document this type of thing. But people report that once they've been opened up by a near-death experience, they remain opened up. And they can often perceive things that other people don't seem to perceive. They're often more intuitive, more sensitive to other people's thoughts and feelings. And sometimes they also report having physical abilities they didn't have before. Healing abilities or abilities to affect electronic equipment, often involuntarily. For example, people will frequently report being unable to wear a wristwatch after a near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
Or they will report that as they go by, they walk down the street, street lights will blow out as they walk by them. People will report often their car batteries being drained frequently after a near-death experience. So there are these reports of not only psychic phenomena, but also strange electromagnetic phenomena, which may be related to the healing abilities that people have or claim to have after a near-death experience.
Hmm. So as you said then, that you, as you know, there's no experimental work that has tried to confirm that the people's reports of being more psychic is actually true?
Well, I'm not aware that anyone's ever tried to measure that. There are, as I said, several surveys of near-death experiences that have documented an increase in reports of psychic phenomena.
Right.
But I'm not aware of anyone who's actually tried to measure that.
Well, it sounds like there's a good research project staring us in the face.
Right.
Well, given the state of the art, what we know about people's reports and the veridical descriptions, which are confirmed occasionally, other than the AWARE project, what do you see then as the next step that can be taken to understand more about the nature of what a near-death experience is and what it means?
Well, of course, the AWARE project has other aspects, too, that I hadn't mentioned, including a lot of the physiological monitoring. Among other things, they are measuring the levels of oxygen in the brain, which hasn't been done before. And they're measuring various proteins that are released by dying nerve cells that hasn't been done before to document exactly what is going on in the brains of these people as they're having near-death experiences. So even if people do not report the visual targets, there's a lot of information that will come out of the AWARE project. Beyond that, there's a lot of research going on with the after effects of near-death experiences and looking at experiences that occur in other circumstances that may be similar to NDEs. For example, there's been reports for centuries about people having mystical experiences like NDEs in the course of seizures, particularly temporal lobe seizures. Dostoevsky wrote about this, and in fact, there are anecdotes that appear in the neurological literature going back to the 19th century of people claiming to have mystical experience in seizures. But again, no one has really studied this. We are currently doing a project at the University of Virginia interviewing every patient in the epilepsy clinic, looking at the types of experiences they report during their seizures and correlating that with the physiological data that we have about the seizure itself, exactly where it's located in the brain, what are the characteristics of the seizure, and so forth. So this will help us pin down if there are, in fact, any brain correlates to these mystical experiences.
Hmm. One of the cases that is sometimes used to talk about near-death experience was the case of Pam Reynolds.
Yes.
Why don't you describe that case, because it really is quite remarkable.
It is a very dramatic case. This was a woman who had an aneurysm, which is a ballooning out of a blood vessel, which is a very dangerous process. If you imagine an old automobile tire that they kind of used to have where they could balloon out, and as the walls of a tire get stretched, it becomes weaker and weaker so that it can burst. And this happens to blood vessels. And as they get larger and larger and balloon out, they may eventually burst and then bleed out. And when this happens in the brain, it is rapidly fatal because the brain is encased in this rigid skull, so there's no room to expand. So the brain is compressed then by the blood spilling out of the aneurysm. So when people have an aneurysm like this, it needs to be surgically removed. And Pam Reynolds had an aneurysm in a very deep part of the brain that was very inaccessible. At the time she had this, which was in the early 1980s, they had just developed a new procedure called hypothermic circulatory arrest. And what this process did was essentially drain all of the blood out of the body, and once the blood is out of the body, the surgeon can go in and cut open the head, cut open the brain, and get to where this aneurysm is and safely cut it out. Now, usually we can't survive very long without any blood in our bodies. So they did a few things to prepare Pam's body to go without blood for a while. And one thing they did was load her up with phenobarbital, which lowers the metabolic rate of the brain. And the other thing they did was to cool her body down about 60 degrees. And at that low temperature, your metabolic rate is very slowed down, so you can survive for maybe 45 minutes without blood circulating and still survive. Normally, after about 4 minutes without blood circulating, you start getting serious brain damage. And after about 10 minutes, you get irreversible changes. But with this cooling process, you can last for maybe 45 minutes. So Pam went to this into this procedure. At that point, there were very few places that did it in this country. She lived in Atlanta, and the nearest place was in Phoenix. So she flew out to Phoenix, had this procedure done, and it didn't go well because what they do in this procedure is cut into the vein in your groin, in the artery in your groin, drain the blood out of that into an ice bath, and then back into the vein to cool your body down. And once they started to cut into her right groin, they found that the blood vessel was actually too small for the procedure. So they had to close that up and move to the left side of the body, and that took about 10 minutes longer. So that she was actually going through a much longer procedure than they had hoped. They eventually did get her body cooled down. They drained all the blood out and then opened up her brain and successfully clipped out the aneurysm and sewed it back up. The procedure took so long that they started rewarming her body faster than was usually acceptable. And in fact, that rapid rewarming actually caused a cardiac arrest twice as they were rewarming her. So she was undergoing this very elaborate procedure that basically had her without any blood in her body for a whole hour, followed by two cardiac arrests. During this whole time, her brain waves were continuously monitored. She had zero brain activity. She had no blood in her body, therefore no pulse, no heartbeat, no respirations. She met all the criteria for death for about an hour. When she came out of it, she described a very elaborate near-death experience with the light, with seeing deceased loved ones, and with reporting visual perceptions from an out-of-body perspective, including things like the fact that the surgeons cut into her right groin, found it was too small, had to move to the left side. She described the very unusual type of saw they used to cut her scalp open, which she had not seen before. She described the music that they had playing on the tape player in the operating room while she was unconscious. All these things that she had vivid memories of during a period when she had no blood in her body and therefore no brain activity at all. So this is one of the more elaborate near-death experiences done during post-physiological monitoring that really challenges any of the physiological explanations for NDEs.
One thing you didn't mention is that both her eyes were taped shut and in her ears were they molded earpieces so they would fit her ear exactly? So they molded earpieces making very loud click noises to be able to test the response of her brainstem.
That's right. That's right. The eyes were taped shut because she's not going to be blinking for a whole hour, and your eyes would dry out if they remained open. So they taped her eyes shut so she couldn't see anything. And the earpieces were actually playing a 90 decibel click, which is the sound of a loud orchestra a few feet away from you, clicking very rapidly in her ears so they could measure the response of the brainstem to these clicks, and therefore they would know when the brain had stopped functioning. Mm-hmm. So between the molded ear speakers blotting out any other sounds and then the loud, constant clicking in her ears, she couldn't possibly have heard anything in the room, and of course she couldn't see anything with her eyes taped shut.
Right.
But you can't really explain how she knew what was going on in the room during this time.
I had imagined, since some of my research involves precognition, that if she was in some other place where time and space are not quite the same that we experience it in our ordinary awareness, did she report in sequence what happened during the operation, or was her report about things that were true in the operation but out of sequence? In other words, if you're in a timeless place, how do you still keep track of time?
Right. This is one of the anomalies of near-death experiences, that people almost always report that in the near-death experience, time did not exist. It was as if they were experiencing everything simultaneously, and time as we know it just was meaningless. And yet, when they describe the near-death experience to you, they describe it as a sequence of events. This happened, then that happened, then that happened. And in fact, Pam was able to report things that happened in her operating suite in correct chronological sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what we do with that, except try to take it at face value what the experiencers say, that this is not something that can be explained in the English language. It's an ineffable experience.
Right. So actually, it may be that once you translate an experience like that, and this is true for people who have mystical experiences as well, that the very act of translating it into a linear language enforces a chronological order. And
right.
That's why the experience itself is not in time, but simply to express it, it has to be in time. And so, as you said, the curious part of it is that you somehow know what the sequence is, even though that wasn't your actual experience.
It's hard to imagine, though, that we're not doing some disservice to the experience by forcing it into that linear model. You know, the near-death experiencers say, I had this incredible experience that can't be put into words, and we say, that's great, tell me all about it.
Right.
Now, we force them to put it into words that inevitably have to distort the situation.
Right. So it may be that the entire experience, even though it may, when you report it, it's a long time, it may actually occur in a flash. I mean, from our time-like perspective, it's all in a flash, here and gone, quickly.
That's right. That's right. That's right. A lot of these experiences will occur while someone is very momentarily unconscious for a second or a couple of seconds, and yet they report very elaborate experiences that take many, many minutes to try to explain to you.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it does seem like the sense of time is very different in the near-death state.
Right. Well, we're a little after the half hour, so why don't we go to questions from the listening audience?
Okay, great. If you would like to ask a question of our guest, Bruce Grayson, or host, Dean Radin, simply press 1 on your phone keypad now. So while you're thinking about your questions, I will read one of the questions that has been emailed in to us. This question comes from Catherine, and she says, what are the greatest social implications of the understanding of the mystical aspects of near-death experiences?
And actually, I would even expand that and say not just the mystical aspects, but the whole thing.
Right, right. Well, the whole near-death experience really challenges the idea that the mind is limited to the physical brain. Now, we have this brain-mind identity model that's accepted by most physicians, most neuroscientists, that the mind is what the brain does. And it just doesn't seem to fit the near-death experience, in which people have enhanced mental functioning when the brain is clearly not functioning. It's like the old Newtonian physics model, which we had before the 20th century. The old Newtonian physics was very adequate for day-to-day activities. But once the 20th century arrived and we could measure things at very fast and very slow speeds and very large and very small distances, the old Newtonian mechanics was no longer appropriate. And we had to develop relativity and quantum mechanics to explain what was really going on. And I think we're in the same situation with the brain-mind identity model. The materialistic model that mind is nothing more than the brain works fine for our everyday life. You know, when you are hit on the head, you don't think as clearly as you do when you're not. When you're drunk, you don't think as clearly. So clearly, when the brain starts to malfunction, your thinking doesn't remain clear. And that's fine for everyday life. But when you get to the extremes, like a near-death state, that old model seems to break down, and we need something else to explain what's going on. When in these extreme states, the brain is shut down completely, but the mind seems to be going.
Let's try Lucia. Lucia, you have the mic.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
great. Dr. Grayson, I'm a fellow Charlottesvillian.
Oh.
And I'd like, hi. I'd like to know how the study of this subject has changed you over time, you know, personally. How has this affected you personally? And what might you admit to at a dinner party that wouldn't belong in this in the lab?
Thank you. Most people who have near-death experiences talk about the profound changes in their attitude and values and beliefs afterwards. Most profoundly, they are no longer afraid of dying, but they also become more open in many other ways. And I think some of that has rubbed off on me. You can't listen to these stories year after year and not be affected by it. I don't think I have the after effects of a near-death experience, but I think I am much less afraid of dying than I was before I started all this work. I'm much more open to other possibilities. There's a sense of meaning and purpose in the world that near-death experiences seem to have that they didn't have before, and I think I've gotten some of that, the sense that things really do happen for a purpose, that there's something that we all have in common that I wasn't aware of before I did all this work.
Thank you.
There was the second part of the question on what you might be willing to admit, although, we are in a public forum here, but the difference between public and private admissions is very strong in all controversial areas and probably is in this one as well.
You can
decide whether you want to offer something or not.
Well, I'll tell a different story, though. I did a study once looking at people who had made suicide attempts and either did or didn't have near-death experiences. And I would interview them right after the suicide attempt and then every month thereafter. And there were some people who, right after the suicide attempt, told me that nothing had happened. And then a month or two later, they would say, now that I've gotten to know you a bit, I think I can trust you enough to tell you that I did actually leave my body. Then maybe 4 or 5 months later, they would say, well, now that I know you're not going to make fun of me for this, I'll tell you what really happened. And they'll tell me about seeing a deceased loved one. And then a year later, they'll say, well, now that I know you're not going to really treat me like I'm crazy, let me tell you what really happened. And they'll tell you about meeting Jesus. And they keep telling you more and more as they start to trust you more and more. Mm-hmm. And there are some near-death experiences that I've known for 30 years who I'm sure have not yet told me the more personal parts that they just can't share. Some things are just too personal, and it would, in a sense, be profaning the experience by sharing it with somebody else.
That's interesting, because it does suggest then that the percentage of people who report near-death experiences may be a vast underestimate.
That's right. I think that's true.
Let me ask a question that was emailed in from Catherine. And she asks, are you aware of people who have had negative or frightening near-death experiences? And can you speak to that?
Yes, I can. We published a paper about 30 years ago of 50 cases of unpleasant near-death experiences. And this was 50 cases we found in a sample of among 1,000, so they were not common. But here again, we have the same problem of people being unwilling to talk about the experience. And when you think about how hard it is to talk about a pleasant near-death experience, I would imagine it would be much harder to talk about a frightening one. Some people feel that an unpleasant experience is a sign that there's something wrong with them, or they didn't deserve somehow to have a pleasant experience, and they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to share that. They're ashamed of it. Other people feel it was just too frightening to even bring up or to think about. So I'm sure that the incidence of frightening near-death experiences is higher than what we've seen. Having said that, the incidence is very small. And there seem to be different types of unpleasant experiences. The most common type is phenomenologically the same as the pleasant ones, but people experience it unpleasantly. For example, they may feel themselves being involuntarily ripped out of their body and thrust down a tunnel at terrifying speed into a blinding light. and they're often very frightened by that experience. Sometimes people report to us that they are really very uncomfortable with this and trying to fight against it, and at some point they give up fighting and just relax into it, and at that point it is transformed into a beautiful experience, which suggests that what's unpleasant about the NDE for these people is the resistance to it, not the experience itself. There's a second type of unpleasant NDE that is an experience of being just in a black void with nothing. No sights, no sounds, just nothingness for eternity. That can be a very terrifying experience for people. Most of those cases we have, I should say, came from people who were given anesthesia. So I am not sure whether that is an effect of the anesthesia or another type of near-death experience. The third type is a type that has graphic, prototypical hellish imagery, fire and brimstone and demons. That's by far the smallest group we've had. But I should say that all these unpleasant experiences we've had have been very few in number, so few that we can't say anything for sure about anything about what's causing them. What we do know, though, is that they tend to have less profound after effects than the blissful experiences. And that may be because people just try to put it out of their minds and don't focus on it the way people tend to focus on the pleasant ones.
Well, I want to thank you, Bruce, for the intriguing and interesting discussion we had tonight.
And well, thank you for inviting me, Dean.
You're welcome. Is there an email that someone can use to contact you if they have something interesting they'd like to ask?
Yes, I'd be delighted to hear from any near-death experiencer. My email address is cbg4d@virginia.edu.
Very good. Thanks again.
Okay, well, thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.